Translation. One who accepts the sannyas order gives up the three principles of materialistic activities in which one indulges in the field of household life, namely religion, economic development, and sense gratification. One who first accepts sannyas, but then returns to such materialistic activities, is to be called a vantasi. Vantashi. Or one who eats his own vomit. He is indeed a shameless person. Please repeat. One who accepts the sannyas order gives up the three principles of materialistic activities in which one indulges in the field of household life, namely religion, economic development, and sense gratification. One who first accepts sannyas, but then returns to such materialistic activities, is to be called a vantashi, or one who eats his own vomit. He is indeed a shameless person. Purport. Materialistic activities are regulated by the institution of Varnashram Dharma. Without Varnashram Dharma, materialistic activities constitute animal life. Yet even in human life, while observing the principles of Varna and Ashram, Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, Brahmacharya, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, and Sannyas, one must ultimately accept Sannyas, the renounced order. For only by the renounced order can one be situated in Brahmasukha, or transcendental bliss. In Brahmasukha, one is no longer attracted by lusty desires. Indeed, when one is no longer disturbed, especially by lusty desires for sexual indulgence, he is fit to become a sannyasi. Otherwise, one should not accept the sannyas order. If one accepts sannyas at an immature stage, there is every possibility of his being attracted by women and lusty desires, and thus again becoming a so-called grihastha, or a victim of women. Such a person is most shameless, and he is called vantashi, or one who eats that which he has already vomited. He certainly leads a condemned life. In our Krishna consciousness movement, it is advised, therefore, that the sannyasis and brahmacharis keep strictly aloof from the association of women, so that there will be no chance of their falling down again as victims of lusty desires. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Shtapitam Nena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Sva Padantikam. Jai Srila Prabhupada Ki. Well, this purport by Srila Prabhupada hardly needs any further commentary. We have it very clearly here. In fact, in most cases, Prabhupada says exactly what the verse needs in order to be fully understood. So the main thing that Prabhupada is saying here, since it is my job to sit on this cushion and say something about this, is that the first thing we understand from this verse is that religion is a materialistic activity. How is that possible? And it says here, the sannyasi gives up principles of materialistic activities in which one indulges in the field of household and life. Namely, okay, we can understand economic development because that's all about money. Okay? And household of life, you absolutely have to have money because you have dependents. You have people who are depending on you for money. Wife, children, and household animals and things like that. Sense gratification, okay, we understand that. Life is all about abandoning sense gratification, and household life is, you know, there's, you know, apple crumble and custard, not just on a Monday night, but every night if you want it. Okay? That's real sense gratification. Apple crumble every night. Or you can have pizza, or you can have ice cream. I was told by a sannyasi when I was a brahmachari, he said, He said, householders, he said, sometimes they have pizza. And I, at that time, I was 26 years old, but I'd never had pizza. I didn't know what a pizza was. It wasn't a common thing in England. It was a kind of an American thing, you know. Never had it. So I just nodded my head and said, okay, so Grihastas have pizza. You know, as if pizza was like, this is the height of degradation, of sense gratification in which you can be immersed in householder life. What to speak of ice cream? Anyway, so unfortunately he didn't frighten me well enough. But here it says that religion is part of the materialistic activity. So what does that mean? It means that true religion means following the Vedas, and most of following the Vedas is to do with promotion of some kind. Prabhupada says all of materialistic life can be summed up in two things: maximizing your happiness, minimizing your unhappiness. He said, this is the struggle for existence. So miseries will come of their own accord. You don't have to plan for them. You don't have to make any arrangements. They just come. So poverty comes if you just stop working one day. So you have to work in order to avoid poverty, because money gets spent. Basically, you have to eat and you have to pay for a house. Either either your father gave you a house and you have to pay for the upkeep, or you're paying off a mortgage, or you're paying rent. But basically speaking, if you want to live somewhere and be protected from the rain, then you have to have a house. So just to pay for the house, for shelter, you have to have money. And the money has to be coming in regularly. So this is part of materialistic activity. You must have it. And sense gratification must be there, because you have to eat. Eating is sense gratification. It may be a mild form of sense gratification. We usually think of sexual indulgence when we think of householder life, but there's eating also in all the different ashrams. So even if you're a householder, you have to pay to, you have to pay to eat. And then if children come as a byproduct of sexual indulgence, then you have to pay for them for a very long time. They've calculated now that paying for a child, on average, parents pay £100,000 per child. That should be enough to frighten any brahmachari away from householder life. If you want to have a child, basically speaking, that will rob you blind of all the money that you could ever acquire in one lifetime. It's a very serious thing. It's not just as one devotee who 6 months ago he had gone from being a brahmachari to being a householder, and he sat here giving a Bhagavatam class, and he said, householder life, it's just the same as when I was a brahmachari, but now someone irons my dhotis. What is the difference? What is the difference between the two ashrams? Nothing. And I was sitting and I was going, oh dear. Wait until 6 months has become a year and a year has become 2 years. Prabhupada said after 2 years, then the householders, he said, then they wake up. And then they see just how expensive it is. So if you want money in order to pay for everything in life, you have to pray to God. This is the basic principle. You have to pray to God, or you have to pray to gods. So this type of religion is materialistic, because the end of that religion is that I will get something. Now, it is true, if you pray to Lord Shiva for money, you will get money. Hey, if you pray to Lord Ganapati for money, you will get money. That's the way the universe works, folks. And if you pray to Lord Krishna for money, not only will you not get money, but you'll get less than you started with. This is a very bad deal. Therefore, for a good, faithful Hindu to surrender to Krishna, it's a big deal. If you're from an Indian background and you know the way the universe works, Okay, that you can be happy in this life and happy in the next. But if you surrender to Krishna, you're admitting, actually there is no happiness in this world and there's no happiness in the next. No? Because the next is just an accumulation of everything that I have done in this life. So that is why religion is in two parts. One is for happiness in this life, and one is for happiness in the next. Whether the next is the heaven, heavenly planets, and there is a heaven, and you do go there if you perform religious activity. That's the way it works. Or you have a next life in which you lead a heavenly life. Some people just seem to be born into a heavenly life. You know? Some people have it. They said to be born with a silver spoon in one's mouth. So from the very early age, you know, one is born into a rich and successful family. You don't have to be a fallen yogi to be born in the family of a millionaire here in Radlett. Okay? You don't have to be a fallen yogi. You can just be a person who was extremely pious in their last life. That's good enough. Prabhupada said one time, he said the Beatles, he said they got all their melodies from the heavenly planets. He said that's where they were in their last life. That's where all these tunes come from. So Paul McCartney, one day he woke up in the morning and he went to the piano because he'd been dreaming of a tune. And he played the tune on his piano even without thinking about it. And this tune went on to become one of his most famous tunes. So it just came to him very, very easily. And that tune made him millions of pounds. So when money comes and you don't have to do anything for it, would we not all like to be in that situation? Huh? Brahmacharis, okay? Every day you go out with your book bag and all of a sudden, within the first 5 minutes, someone comes, are you one of those Hare Krishna guys? Do you have one of those those Gita things? Okay, yeah, I do. You know, I've been thinking of donating all my wealth to a good cause. Did you know that I was a multimillionaire? You might have heard of me. Anyway, today's your lucky day, my friend. Here it is. We dream of such days, don't we? You can retire. But when money comes unsought, practically unsought, you should know that it's the result of past punya. So therefore, one who is very clever follows the Vedas and prays to the demigods, or follows the Vedas and performs the five types of fire sacrifices. And these five types of fire sacrifices, they're done in householder life. A year ago, I met a sannyasi who had been doing these five types of fire sacrifices every single day of his householder life. He was asked by his guru, who was then sick. He said, I want you to be the next acharya, so I want you to take sannyas. And within a week, he'd tied up his family business, and he came with his wife and performed all the five household fire sacrifices. She got up with a few friends. She went home. At the end of the fire sacrifice, she went home. At the end of the fifth fire sacrifice, she got up and she went home with some friends. He got up. He went down to the river. He shaved his head, took a bath, and spent the entire day in study. Next morning, he woke up. Another sacrifice. He took on the clothes of a sannyasi, and now he's the chinajir, which is the junior acharya. The senior acharya is still alive, so now he's in training. So now they go everywhere together. So when everybody knows that when the acharya dies, this person is the acharya, and that's how it's done in some cultures. But I was surprised, because in many cases we hear descriptions of persons who take sannyas, as Lord Chaitanya did, leaving in the middle of the night, or but it doesn't have to be done that way. It doesn't have to be done by surprise. It can be done with the wife's permission. Of course, the wife will never say yes, or she'll say very reluctantly yes. But unfortunately, there comes a time when we all must leave. There comes a time when death is involuntary sannyas. Death is involuntary sannyas. And, you know, it's very interesting, actually. Before I had a major operation for cancer, and they told me that there's a 10% risk with this operation that you may not make it. 10%. So I said, all right, thank you for telling me that. And so that morning, I wrote a letter in which I basically, I just said goodbye to everyone. And I wrote about my life in Krishna consciousness. I still have the letter. I looked at it yesterday, actually. I found it, you know, in a pile of papers. So I wrote the letter and I said goodbye to everyone. I said thank you to everybody in ISKCON. I said how wonderful life had been, how Prabhupada had given my life meaning. I wrote to my children. I wrote to my wife. And then some nurses came into the room. But I was, you know, because I'd been fasting for 24 hours, you know, and fasting, you get a little bit giddy. So what had happened was I didn't know that they were nurses when they came in. So they came in and they said, well, good morning. We've come to take you home. I thought, oh my God, the time's come. The time has come. Anyway, I'm still here. So I didn't give up. I didn't give up this body. I gave up part of it. I gave up more than I wanted to. Actually, they told me afterwards how much they'd taken out, and it was more than we'd agreed on. But nevertheless, it saved my life, and I'm still here. So Hare Krishna. But it is quite astonishing that when you do think that you might go, how your consciousness changes. And what sannyas is, it's saying, okay, well, if you're going to do that anyway, you might as well do it slightly before you die. Why not? Because why not be in that elevated consciousness? Why not renounce that which never fully belonged to you anyway? So this renunciation we often speak of, as Narad Muni is in this verse speaking of it, as a giving up, a tyagam. We're giving up of materialistic activities. In one sense, Ramanujacharya, he says that actually sannyasis, the higher principle of sannyas is not to give anything up. He said you don't give up your family. He says this is the higher principle of sannyas. But the whole world becomes your family. It's not a giving up, it's a taking on. Instead of just narrowing your consciousness to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people and just a few square meters of what the place you call home, your consciousness expands to the point where every single human being becomes your family and every single part of God's earth becomes your home. And that's why a sannyasi can be with anyone and he can be with his family. He can feel this person as a friend, as he sees as a friend. You cannot see a person as a friend unless you see everybody as a friend. Because if you see a friend for any other materialistic reason, you'll also see others as enemies. This is the mode of passion. It means that this is my friend because he or she will give me something. Either they will give me some support or some comfort or some words of honor or respect. This type of sannyas is not sannyas, you see. And a sannyasi Prabhupada says sometimes becomes attached to the few small possessions that he has, such as his deity, his begging bowl, his japa beads, like that, he said. But this type of attachment is permitted. The very small number of items that a sannyasi has is permitted, but nothing more. But in another sense, sannyas is still part of the varnashram system. you're still working within the Varnashram system. Although it's the last stage of the Varnashram system, but you're still within it. There are four Varnas, and a sannyasi has nothing to do even with a Brahmin Varna. That's the thing. Brahmin Varna means that you're still interested in making money. You don't have much interest, but you're still interested in performing religious activities or doing fayagyas or teaching. Sannyasis don't do fayagyas. They don't do any kinds of fayagyas. But Prabhupada says, in order to get my students married, I sometimes do, although it is not very much heard of. So sannyas also means that you don't have any living spaces that you can call your own. You live in different places. But then we find three different types of activities, three different Hare Krishna movements that came from the pure teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in which sannyas was practiced in different ways. One was the sannyas of living within householder life, but being detached. This is also another form. Of course, this verse doesn't talk about that, so I shall try not to talk about that. And that was the movement of Nityananda Prabhu. And Nityananda Prabhu had many householder followers, but they led pure lives. And Prabhupada said, one who is a faithful wife at home and is living a detached life, he has no need of taking sannyas. Of course, he wrote that to a young man who wanted to take sannyas probably about 2-3 years after he'd got married. So it was a conciliatory letter, so we can't use that as Shastra, I'm afraid. And the next type of sannyas is what you might call eremitic sannyas. Eremitic sannyas means that you, that's a Latin word actually, it means a hermit. It means that you sleep under a different tree every night. There are various books like Yati Vimshati and different books written by, you know the story of Yadava Prakash, who was the Kula Guru of Ramanujacharya when he was a young man, and he was decrying the lotus, the pink lotus eyes of God by saying that this was like the back of a monkey. And Ramanuja, as a boy, he cried on the shoulder of his teacher. That whole story, which you may have heard before. Anyway, later on, Yadava Prakash became chastened, and he became a disciple of Ramanuja. And then he went on to write a book, which I can't remember the name of, but it was a book about Yati, which was... can't remember the name. Anyway, it was a book about how sannyasis live. And it's very important to have a padati for sannyas, otherwise people just sort of invent their own rules. For every ashram, there's rules. And you might as well follow Shastra, because if you don't, you end up in a difficult situation. So the rules for sannyas are quite stringent, actually. There's another type of sannyas that is sort of post-Buddhism. And what happened at the time of Buddhism in India was that they then became the sannyasis. They sort of took over India. India became a Buddhist nation. And Vedic sannyasis became depressed. What to speak of Vaishnava sannyasis became quite depressed as a class. And in order to defeat Buddhism, Shankara came, and he went to all the places that the Buddhists had gone to. If you want to take over a country, you make sure you do teaching. But you capture the places that are most influential for people who want religious ideas. So you go to Rameshwaram, you go to Puri, you go to Bhadrikashram, you go to Dwarka, you go to places where everybody goes for a religious experience, and you make sure that your teachers become the most famous and unconquered teachers of those places. Then you have vast exposure to thousands and thousands of people. So this is what the Buddhists did. So the Buddhists completely conquered Mathura. They completely conquered Jagannath Puri. Jagannath Puri was a big seat of Buddhist culture. And they conquered all the other places as well. So Shankara, when he came along, he had to change that. So then the Buddhists had started something called a guha. And a guha was a collection of renunciates that all lived in one place. So then Shankara borrowed that idea and put all his sannyasis in one place. Now, sannyasis are supposed to travel the world like a bird flies through the sky or a fish swims through water. They leave no trail. You know, a jet, when it flies through the sky, it leaves a vapor trail. You can see where it's been. A bird flies through, can't tell where the bird was a minute earlier. A fish swims through water, doesn't leave any tracks, can't tell where he's been. So a sannyasi is supposed to leave no tracks. Certainly he's not supposed to leave any children. Okay, we leave other religions to do that. But this is the idea. He's supposed to live as a wandering mendicant. So Shankaracharya changed that in around, when was it, 800 and something. 800 and something. So then the Vaishnavas, when they were dealing with the Shankarites, they had to do exactly the same thing. So Shankaracharya had been based at Sringeri. He'd been based at Sringeri. And Sringeri is just like 20 miles away from the seat of the great Vaishnava Acharya, Madhva Acharya. You can get on a bus in Udupi and you can be driven to Sringeri. So he set himself up at Udupi, not only because that's where the deity of Krishna came, but it was also a very advantageous place for defeating Shankara's philosophy. So then later Vaishnavas, they also, Ramanujacharya was earlier, but all the later Vaishnava sannyasis, they often took what was known as Kshetra sannyas, in which they did have a base. They did have a base, and they didn't leave that place. So sometimes Vrindavan was like that. However, the difficulty is that there are sannyasis who are at the top of the sannyasi sort of tree, so to speak, and there's some sannyasis that just leave home and go to a holy place and then begin to have second thoughts about life. And their Kshetra sannyas is not the same because they get quite comfortable in the holy place. And when they give initiation, sometimes they don't give initiation in a way where the disciples can actually see a sannyas life being demonstrated, you see. And that's difficulty. So that pollutes, if you like, the sannyas tradition within that tradition. And some completely reject the idea of sannyas completely, like the followers of Vallabhacharya. He was a householder. So in that line, they reject the notion of sannyas. And of course, they give this verse that in Kali Yuga, sannyas becomes an aberration. So within the Srimad Bhagavatam, we find the descriptions of taking sannyas. And we also find warnings. We find stories in the fourth canto of Indra dressing as a sannyasi in order to be, in order to come closer to the fire yajna, because if you were just dressed as an ordinary person, you'd be asked, "Can you just like this weekend, we're going to have the initiation of quite a few devotees. The place is going to be packed. If you're dressed like an ordinary person, our stewards will say, can you just sit over there? You know, unless you've got a ticket, you have to sit over there." Okay, so it was like that in Vedic times as well. But if you were dressed as a sannyasi, "Oh, Maharaj, please come in. Please come and sit very close to the fire yajna." So Indra wanted to get very close to the fire yajna, and he dressed as a sannyasi. This technique of dressing like a sannyasi is commented on. It's very, very, you know, I've told you the story before about the Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said some dress like sannyasis and they want to cheat, and some dress like innocent widows and they want to cheat. You know that story? Kumbh Mela. Some dress as sannyasis because they want to meet women, and at Kumbh Mela some dress as widows who have no husbands because they want to get close to those sannyasis, but actually their idea is to bag a sannyasi. So he said, this is cheaters and cheated. But cheaters and cheated, he didn't use that for the likes of us. He used it to describe the situation of the Bawals and the Sahajas, who actually made a very good business of pretending to be renounced and then initiating young women. And, of course, the rest is history. And the rest is history. We even had people who came here one time. The two men who were murderers, they came to Bhaktivedanta Manor. And they said, we're extremely interested in joining your ashram. Well, you know, as soon as someone comes here and says that, you know, what are you running away from? So the night before, they had killed two people in Bedford. So at that time, we did have a guest master. See how important a guest master is. We had a guest master who could read handwriting. He was a graphologist. And he read the handwriting. And then devotees became suspicious. And eventually the police came and said, thank you very much, lads. Scotland Yard came and took them away. Thank you very much. So this tendency to cheat, either to gain respect, or the biggest form of cheating, of course, is to cheat oneself. To cheat yourself. That's the biggest form of cheating. We had one young man who was a brahmachari, and at that time in ISKCON, nobody knew who was. It wasn't like today where people were crisscrossing ISKCON and everybody kind of knew who everybody was. There was internet and you could check things out. There was no internet. There was not even a telephone that would go beyond England. Okay? There's only one telephone in the building that was under the stairs here where we have a cleaning cupboard there. So one telephone in the building, no internet. Anyway, there was one young man who came through here, and as he left here, he had with him, he got to Italy, and he made himself a dunda from three bamboos and a fourth bamboo. And he got some Brahmin, you know, some copin, and wound it around, and he tied his dhoti in a particular way. And he went to Rome, and the devotees in Rome honored him, and every day he was giving classes. And every day he was being given the Maha Prasadam, and until eventually they sort of caught on that perhaps he wasn't quite what he, you know, said he was. So this was trying to fool the devotees into gaining more respect. If one is attracted to sannyas for any other material motivation, it will be revealed. This is the difficulty, and sometimes it's revealed in a very painful way. When you're doing Indian dance sometimes calls upon the dancer to portray one who is vomiting, and it's like this. It's like okay. To vomit is to mean to completely reject something as being unsustainable to one's health. This is the idea. Vomit means that your body has decided that this is no longer required, no longer needed, and in actual fact, it is contrary to principles of sustaining health. And so in this way, one who has vomited something, that is left in a dirty place. So if one's entire consciousness has said, this is no longer this is no longer relevant to sustaining my spiritual health. I don't want this anymore. You see. Om nirasta paravasu. I cast out that which is unneeded. If you've done that, then you can't pick it up again. But you have to be very clear. Sannyas is not just like being a brahmachari and having someone iron your clothes. Each ashram comes with very, very stringent rules. And unfortunately, what we do in ISKCON is that we often use the rules of one ashram to prop up the rules of another. And sometimes, therefore, we have brahmacharis who live like grihastas. Then we have some grihasthas who want to live like brahmacharis. We have some grihasthas who pretend to live like sannyasis, and we have some sannyasis who have all the comforts of household life. This mixing of the ashrams is called Varna Shankara, or Ashram Shankara. Ashram Shankara makes a khichdi of the ashrams. In a khichdi, you can't tell where's the dal, where's the rice, where's the vegetables. It's all mixed together. So not that Varnashram, as propounded and taught and lived by ISKCON, should be a khichdi. No, rather you should have rice, dal, and sabji, you see, and maybe a sweet. Okay, so these things, when they're on the plate, this is slightly more interesting. And khichdi looks a little bit like, you know, I have a very low opinion of khichdi. But, it's Tuesday today, I'm sorry. I was sitting right where Nandan is there. No, you're initiated now, right? Not yet. When? Oh, were you waiting for Krishna to decide? Okay. I was sitting right where you are. Prabhupada was sitting here, and he was giving a class. He wasn't giving a class. It was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Prabhupada had come through that door. He'd come to the deities, and he'd come, and he was speaking. It was just like a welcome address. Sometimes the Prabhupada would speak for 5-10 minutes, then he would go upstairs. So it was a sunny day, like today. He'd come through that door, come to the deities, sat down. Anyway, so he said something had happened in Germany, and he was commenting on it, because he was very grave, very serious. He said, one who takes sannyas, or one who is a sadhu, everyone is looking at him. The whole world is looking at him. And if he does something wrong, everybody will notice. Ordinary man, if he does something wrong, no one will notice. He said, but a sadhu who does something wrong is like a white sheet on which there is a black spot. No one looks at the white sheet, but everybody will. The attention will be on the black spot. So I remember that. 35 years later, I remember that. Because he was commenting that when an ISKCON devotee, especially someone who is at the, you can say, in the top rank of our organization, in one sense it's just an ashram. It's just an ashram. But because Prabhupada was a sannyasi, all the subsequent persons who took sannyas, you could say they took on the accoutrement of the acharya, and therefore they became worthy of respect simply by being sannyasis. But really, it's an ashram. It's simply one of the four ashrams in which to prosecute spiritual life, and it may even be that a particular sannyasi is. It could be spiritually mature, but in other aspects of his life, he's waiting for maturity to take place. It's not that all features find their perfection at the moment one takes sannyas. It would be wonderful if that happened like that, but it doesn't happen. So in our history, we have, and even when Prabhupada was writing this purport, there had been already several leading devotees who he had given sannyas to who had fallen away from sannyas. So often in Prabhupada's purports, we have a little encapsulation of the ISKCON history up to that time. So one time there was Prabhupada was giving sannyas in Vrindavan, and there was a young Bengali boy who had been a Naishtik brahmachari up to that time, and there was another young American who'd had many girlfriends before he came to Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada was going to give him sannyas that morning. And this devotee thought that he was in with a chance. Okay, so he came to Prabhupada and he said, may I also take sannyas? And Prabhupada said, no. But he said, but you're giving such and such sannyas. He said, yes. He said, because you're here in India, and in India, everyone knows what a sannyasi is. And if you make a mistake or you fall away, everyone will talk. He said, but in America, no one knows what a sannyasi is. It's very interesting how Prabhupada saw it. It doesn't give our Western sannyasis perhaps great confidence. But now, of course, people do know what the saffron cloth means. Unfortunately, it's also had a checkered history with others. And we have to make sure that ISKCON is the one movement that restores the saffron cloth to its rightful place as being worthy of not only respect, but worthy of worship. That's why you may be a brahmachari, but we make you wait for a long time before you put on that saffron. So one who again goes back to a householder life, well, of course it's difficult, isn't it? It's difficult to go back to a householder life once one has taken sannyas. You know? It's difficult. How can you do that? How embarrassing that is. How embarrassing for the wife. Sometimes the wife is very happy that the husband takes sannyas. No, I didn't mean it like that. But sometimes she's very honored. Oh, your husband took sannyas. That's wonderful. Your husband is such and such, such and such. Okay. So what a great disgrace. What a great disgrace. And it should be a disgrace. It should be a disgrace. Now, however, what seems to be the case is that sannyasi goes back to mundane activities, or goes back to sexual indulgence, and we are very forgiving. We were very forgiving. We were very keen to welcome that person back in. And for some people, this is reprehensible. Some people do not look upon this kindly. Oh, sannyasi has fallen down, now he's in white. But anyway, he's still a wonderful Vaishnava, Apichet Sudaracharya. Narada Muni's not saying that here. He's saying he's a vomit eater. Now, you can't just be a vomit eater for 2 weeks and then forgiveness to completely swamp every other consideration. Otherwise, what will happen is it gives a license to sannyasis to fall away from sannyas, to be indulgent, because they know that when they come back, everything will pretty much be restored as before. That's why it will tend to confuse the ashrams once again. So that you have to lose something. If you become the eater of vomit, you have to lose some prestige within the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Once having renounced something, you can't keep everything that came as a result of your previous position. There must be some difficulty there. Otherwise, the rest of your life will again be comfortable and you won't learn the valuable lessons that you need to learn. The point is here that there is honesty. Honesty is very much required. Honesty to one's self. I was on a retreat a couple of years ago. I went on a retreat and there was about 15 sannyasis on the retreat. It was a very pleasant retreat. Did I feel a little bit shy, dressed in my shiny white dhotis with my big colored stripes? A little bit, but they were very nice to me. And I did get lots of jokes, looking at their watches. So, how long have you been a grihasta? The point is that what we discussed was very much that in all of the ashrams, one has to be very much honest. And that honesty with oneself is part and parcel of spiritual life. And honesty should extend to at least one or two others. Because unless that comes out, we hold on to it and it doesn't do very much inside us. It can't help us. So moving through the ashrams is a natural progression. But at the same time, if one has chosen to be situated in a particular ashram, then one has to observe the rules of that ashram. You know, when I was a brahmachari, you just were not allowed to eat sweets during the week. You just couldn't eat sweets. You were not allowed any sugar. And it was something that was kind of there. Either it was just here in ISKCON, or it was just, and we knew that someone who did, he was a brahmachari, but, you know, not really. You know, because real brahmacharis distribute books and they don't eat sweets. Brahmacharis get up early and they come to Mangalarti and they take bath in cold water. There was just different little things by which we lived a brahmachari life. But as soon as you... Brahmacharis don't have nice shoes. They don't have nice clothes. They don't drive a big, powerful car. Now, these are the things that, you know, you leave behind. And we had very uncomplimentary words for brahmacharis who sort of wanted to live one kind of life, but wanted to be brahmacharis at the same time. And what to speak of sannyasis. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati wouldn't even let his sannyasis wear shoes at all. What to speak of nice shoes. He wore shoes when he went to important preaching programs. But other than that, they weren't allowed to wear shoes. They weren't even allowed to go to the dentist. You read his rules for people who live in the ashram. It's like, you think, I could never live in such an ashram. Prabhupada was more lenient. He was more lenient. But it's not that we can copy Prabhupada's lenience and then in the next generation be more lenient, and the next generation after that be more lenient. Shastra doesn't change. You know, there's compassion and consideration and adjustment. But ultimately, when Shastra says, this is how a brahmachari lives, or this is how a sannyas lives, or this is how a grihastha lives, one has to follow that, or at least endeavor to rise to that particular level of qualification. And yes, there's respect when you rise to that level of qualification, but there also has to be some penalties for when you don't. Now you have a name, Vantasi. Someone who's given up the sannyas order, you don't call them Maharaj. It's Vantasi. Otherwise, somewhere deep within your mind, you'll start thinking that this is a possibility, that there's four ashrams, but maybe five. Then there's grihastha life, but maybe there's another, maybe there's six. And you end up with eight ashrams, and so on, and you keep multiplying the ashrams until you get to the one that you really want. And then you live in that ashram. No, there's four ashrams, and you make your choice. And once you've made your choice, then you stay there, and you follow the rules of that ashram. And I can tell you, if you do, you'll be successful in spiritual life, but it'll never be comfortable. Because actually it's arranged in such a way that the brahmachari life is uncomfortable, grihastha life is uncomfortable, vanaprastha life is uncomfortable, and sannyas life is uncomfortable. Why? Because the whole material world is not a place to be comfortable. The rules and regulations for household life make it just as uncomfortable as any other ashram. It just looks that there's extra, something extra. But unfortunately it's not. Except if you try to use the householder life and try to live like a brahmachari. Or try to use the sannyas life and try to live it like grihastha life. That cannot be done. Is that all right? Hare Krishna. Now it's time for your khichdi. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Granth Raj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.